Today I'm going to talk to you about the process and outcome results for understanding food insecurity and food shopping practices of Liberian refugees and immigrants in the U.S. No relationships to disclose. So here's the quick outline, background, methods, you know, the whole rigmarole. And I'd like to give you the background on our study area. This is a really diverse study area in Guilford County, North Carolina. And our focus here is Liberian African refugees and immigrants. There's several ways they come to our country. Guilford County has a population of about 489,000, and about 19% of this population receives SNAP benefits. And it's been documented that over 170 different first languages in our schools and 145 different ethnic groups in our schools, so which gives you some context for how diverse this small area is. And I want to give you some of the Liberian political and migration history just to put this in context. There's been intense civil unrest beginning in 1980, leading to full-fledged civil war. And that's lasted on and off in various skirmishes from 1989 to 2003. And they just recently reached stability with the election of their president in 2005. And during this time, over 200,000 were killed and millions were displaced. And most resettlement in the U.S. occurred in 2004, and this was after the peak battle where fighting got into the capital of Monrovia. And here you can see, if I can get my mouse, there's Liberia, very small country, West African country. And it's estimated now that over 39,000 live in the U.S., and they're mainly along the east coast of the U.S., New York, particularly, we think it's hard to say because the estimates are from 2006. We haven't updated this data, but there's over 1,000 living in Guilford County, we believe. And why is food security important? You're probably all kind of familiar with this paradigm, how food insecurity can lead to poor diet quality. The cheapest foods are usually the lowest in nutrients, highest in calories. And of course, that leads to chronic disease and poor health outcomes like diabetes, hypertension, and then leading to overall social health productivity and stability cost in the country. You know, insurance goes up when we're all paying for diabetes care. And then we feel that refugees there's a greater impact for them because they come from unstable living conditions of the refugee camps, where, you know, they're dependent on food. There's probably no unemployment other than bartering and trade. And then education is virtually non-existent. It really depends on the level of the camp and what they can provide, but most often it's not provided at all. Which brings us to our study criteria and objectives. The study was approved by our IRB, and the criteria for the interviews was that the woman was a mother of Liberian origin living in Guilford County, North Carolina, who was the main meal preparer of her household and had at least one child 12 years or younger. And the objectives of the study were to understand desirable characteristics of community interviewers working with Liberian mothers, and then assess severity of food insecurity among Liberian households and identify characteristics of those with food insecurity, and then learn about common food shopping and dietary practices that may relate to food insecurity. Our interviewer selection methods, we used a community interviewer model where we looked for a woman of similar origin and background who was familiar with the culture, the norms, languages, and just had an overall sense of how to deal with this population. So ideally, a Liberian woman who was a mother. And the interviewers were recruited through community and outreach programs for church groups and things that work with African and refugee groups. And training lasted for about 1 to 2 weeks. And we used role-playing, direct observation, and step-by-step direction to train. And the interviewer had to be able to conduct interviews in the presence of one of the research assistants. And for the results of this community interviewer selection, only one of the four women trained were selected to conduct interviews, and this was based on some key characteristics that we really observed were necessary, absolutely necessary to do this work. And that was being engaged, invested, able to explain the purpose of the study in non-technical language, being non-judgmental about tribal affiliations, which is a huge source of contention and discrimination in this group, and then understanding and implementing IRB protocols and assuring the participants of confidentiality. I know you mentioned that was an issue with your group as well. And overall neutrality to the participants' responses, living conditions, and other situations that could be somewhat sensitive. And of course, benefits of having a community interviewer. She gave us access to this community that we might not otherwise have been able to get. She was able to translate cultural concepts that we're just not aware of, and explain and identify novel foods to the U.S. diet, and then help to build trust with this group. And our study methods were that participants were recruited by the interviewer using a snowball sampling method, whereby after initial interviews, we'd ask if they had anybody that they could suggest might be interested or kind of spread the word. And we had a total of 15. We still have several more interviews to analyze with this for our preliminary results. We had 15. And our assessment included three sections. There was a descriptive questionnaire that included like age, income, education level. We'll look at that a little bit. And a semi-structured interview guide. And most importantly, the focus of our study was the USDA 18-item food security scale. Interviews were conducted for approximately 90 minutes in the person's home by the community interviewer. And they were audio tape recorded and then transcribed by the interviewer. And here's a breakdown of the assessment. You can see the descriptive questionnaire, age, income, education, marital status. We even asked whether or not they had insurance, if their children had insurance. A lot of demographic data was collected. The semi-structured interview guide included food shopping, budget, management, differences in lifestyle and eating habit questions. And this was kind of open-ended and fixed questionnaire. Like we could ask some, like how did you eat, or how many times per day did you eat back in your home country versus here? And then the USDA 18 item food security scale, our focus. And there's an example question if you're not familiar with this tool. Which brings us to, how do you evaluate the food security scale? Here's a quick breakdown. It's based on three constructs, and it's anxiety, quality, and quantity around food in the past 30 days. So it's not necessarily that there's a lack of food. There can be an anxiety about trying to acquire food. And each affirmative answer, there's 18 different questions, and each affirmative answer equals 1 point, and the sum of those affirmative answers is the food security score. And individuals are categorized on the total score. So you can see food secure is zero affirmative answers, which means they have no anxiety about food or anything. Mild, 1 to 6 scores, affirmative answers. And that's usually around household anxiety about access to food and maybe some reduced quality of the diet. And then moderate, 7 to 12 affirmative answers, is where you're seeing anxiety, reduced quality and quantity in the adults' diets. And then severe, 13 to 18 affirmative answers. This is where you see both adults' reduced quality and quantity and children's child hunger. This is where we really see that. So. Which brings us to what our findings. And you can see that while 33% were food secure, even in the small sample, 67% experienced some level of food insecurity. And it's interesting to note that 13% food insecure, so it's severe food insecurity. So that's at least 2 households out of the 15 surveyed that have child hunger, meaning they've cut portions, skipped meals, and reduced the quality of children's meals in the household. And that's due to being able to afford to get more food. The descriptive characteristics here will highlight just for time's sake. You can see that it was statistically significant that income and unemployment were income was much lower, unemployment much higher in the food insecure group, which is to be expected. These are factors that we know directly impact food insecurity. And it's also interesting to note, although they weren't statistically significant, 27% did not own a car and 20% had no formal education. That's no elementary, no kindergarten, no schooling whatsoever. So those two factors, even though not statistically significant here, directly impact employment. So, and that also leads to food insecurity. And I wanted to get on some of the adult dietary habits, just because this was really interesting paradigm we found, is that there's a huge division between adult and child eating patterns. And I'd like to go back to that stat about how these women have been in this country for an average of 12 years. So they haven't really acculturated, in terms of acculturation, they haven't really taken on our eating patterns. So you see, they almost exclusively eat African foods, like you see the peppers, smoked fish, palm oil. And these foods are typically in small ethnic stores, and they're imported and pretty expensive. So, and we can see in the child eating patterns, the parents claim that they will not eat African foods. And this is a big source of contention in the house, because the parents are ending up cooking two meals and buying the second set of groceries, which also contributes to food costs. And they express a big preference for pizza, fries, hot dogs, some of that peer influence from school, probably. So. And then shopping habits, you can see that we have several small ethnic stores in Greensboro or Guilford County. It's actually, for I guess since it's so diverse, we're lucky to have those. And we have several large ethnic grocery stores as well. But the parents tend to shop at these large chain stores like Walmart and Costco for the kid-friendly foods, of course. And they tend to shop at the large chain stores more often, probably more on a weekly basis, in several different stores trying to find the best deals. And then they shop at the small ethnic stores probably more of a monthly basis. They're a little further away from their house, the housing areas. And in conclusion, of course, community interviewers need certain characteristics to work with Liberian mothers to make this more effective. And the Liberian population in Guilford County does appear to be vulnerable to food insecurity. And we want to really investigate that strong division between adult and child diets that may be influencing high food costs that we were seeing, and therefore contributing to that food insecurity. The next steps is that we would really like to investigate the role of pre-migration factors in food insecurity. So we were seeing that there is some difference between rural and urban. If they grew up in a rural area, access to education is limited. There's different types of jobs in the rural areas than there would be in the urban areas of Liberia. And further develop and test the training module for community interviewers based on those observed characteristics that we found. And then assess the dietary intake to identify nutrient deficiencies related to chronic disease for this group, since there's not much data on that for this particular population. And we would like to look at a 12-month food insecurity scale, seeing as we looked at the 30-day, and this was conducted during the summer when kids were out of school and might not have had access to the school free or reduced lunch programs. So we'd like to see how that impacts it. And then identify the relative cost of traditional African foods compared to the overall food budget, since we're seeing pretty high costs there, and we think this may be putting them at risk. And I'd like to acknowledge my advisor, Dr. Jigna Durod, our fearless leader, and our community interviewer. Without her, this would not have been possible, Doris de Gardia, and my trusty research assistants, Morgan and Brandy, who slog through transcripts for me. So. And my references. Thank you.